This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When preparing dinner, do you ever wonder, is this done? And when trying to cook something new, do you find yourself thinking, am I on the right track? Today on the Afternoon Magazine, internationally recognized chef and cooking teacher Anne Willen offers us her guidance on these questions and others. We'll talk with her about how to cook things properly and what to do when things haven't gone quite right. Don't hesitate to join us with a phone call. Questions are encouraged. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Wherever else you may be listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Anne Willen is the founder and president of the French cookery school, La Varenne. She is a former president of the International Association of Culinary Professionals. And she's the author of many cookbooks, including Look and Cook. That 17-volume collection is the basis for the PBS series Look and Cook with Anne Willen. Her latest book is titled Anne Willen's Cook It Right. It's published by Reader's Digest. Toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anne Willen, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. It's good to be with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you. What is your earliest memory of food?
Wow. That would be in the kitchen when I was very small, making cookies, I think, hopefully most of us.
Yeah.
Apparently, I was a desperately greedy child, and the only thing that upset me was when I wasn't given enough to eat, and I would open my mouth and yell. But apart from that, I just sat very placidly.
You know, we talk from time to time with cooks and food writers on this program, and it's always interesting to hear about when and how and why people become truly interested in food. Some were children, some in their teens, others older. When and how and why did cooking become an interest? When did you move beyond hoping to have a cookie to wanting to really have, you know, some say in the kitchen?
Well, it was probably comparatively late, though I always loved being in the kitchen. My mother was in the garden. I was always in the kitchen. It was during the Second World War in England. And as far as I was concerned, the best things went on in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I was sent, as you can tell, I had a very British upbringing. And I was sent away to boarding school and had a very academic education, which was the best education in those days, and I went to Cambridge University and have an MA in economics, and it was regarded as anything domestic really was a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent my life until then teaching myself dressmaking, needlework, lace making, not so much cooking, but certainly anything indoors. Quantities of reading, of course. And then when I graduated, I was not an intellectual, and I graduated okay, but with, I guess, what you call a C degree, which in England at Cambridge is called a third-class degree, which doesn't qualify you to teach. And they said, well, dear, you'd better do a secretarial course.
Oh, my.
And I said, I'm damned if I'm going to do a secretarial course. And so I went to teach needlework and dressmaking, which was a great love of my life. And the school was affiliated with the Cordon Bleu in London. And so from teaching, I moved to do a 3-month cooking course. And once in the kitchen, that was it. I stayed on to teach at the Cordon Bleu in London. And then, I mean, there was never the smallest question of ever wanting to do anything else.
Mm.
And aren't I lucky?
Yes. You've done very well.
Well, I think to have a vocation like that, that's wonderful.
Mm. Well, at this point, I must say congratulations on all your, on all the things that you have accomplished and the recognition that you have seen.
Well, it's a wonderful world, the world of cooking, and it certainly takes me all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the opportunities for everybody are opening up all the time.
Hmm. In the late spring or early summer, your mother would have you shell peas for soup.
Yes, she would. Full of nasty little worms, they were, too.
Oh, you didn't put that in the book.
No, I didn't put that in the book, but they were, because in England we always had a lot of rain, yes.
And her way of dealing with peas of varying size was to make soup.
That's it.
How old were you?
Oh, I was quite small then.
Yeah.
Because my mother only grew vegetables during the war. And she would grow the vegetables in among the flowers because she was a great flower gardener. And I can remember the onions growing in among the roses. And she grew enough vegetables. She grew huge quantities of tomatoes because, of course, there was no citrus, because there was very little imported anything, and certainly not citrus fruits. And so she would can 200 small jars of tomatoes every year, and I would have a half jar of tomatoes every night for my supper. And I still regard tomatoes with a jaundiced eye. And so shelling the peas, well, I have to look up which page is pea soup.
Page 151.
Thank you. Which, if you want the exact recipe for it, of course it comes out a wonderful bright green color.
Mm-hmm.
And for 4 to 6 people, you need about 2.5 pounds of peas in the pod. But, of course, a lot depends on the size of the peas. And if they're lovely baby peas, you'll need more than that because the pods will be relatively heavy as with the little peas inside. And then you need 2 tablespoons of butter and a finely chopped onion. And my mother probably didn't add this in those days, but I like to add it, which is a finely chopped clove of garlic. She certainly had a quart of chicken stock, because one of the things that we kept were chickens. And then for seasoning, I put a teaspoon, but you kind of probably need a large pinch of sugar, salt and pepper, and very English and absolutely vital for the English flavor to peas is a large bunch of fresh mint. And in England, we always simmer peas with fresh mint. And, of course, it gives it a kind of sparky freshness.
Mm.
And then at the end of the cooking, you're going to need about 1/2 cup of heavy cream.
Mm.
And so you shell the peas, and there should be about 3 cups of peas. And then in a soup pot, you melt the butter and add the onion and garlic and sauté until they're soft but not brown, which probably takes between 3 and 5 minutes, and then add everything else, the peas, the stock, the sugar, salt and pepper, and boil, bring to a boil, and simmer until the peas are more tender than if you were going to eat them just as peas. You want them to start popping and therefore easy to puree, because if they're still quite firm, if the outside skins are firm, you're going to have slightly lumpy soup.
Mm.
And then you can either puree them with one of those handheld blenders, or else you can just put them in the food processor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put them, put it back into the pot, reheat it, add chopped mint leaves, and cream. You can add just a spoonful or two of cream. I think it does need a little bit because it gives it it lightens the color a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pour it into bowls and add a tablespoon of cream to each bowl and just stir it to marble it.
That sounds so good.
And it's very good chilled as well.
Mm.
And dare I say that out of season, actually, it's very good made with frozen peas.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And I am not a canned and frozen food buff at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of the very few things that I do sometimes.
Now, what do you think of canned stock?
You've got to watch it. Because you need the no salt or very low sodium mm-hmm. canned stock. And it's certainly better than tap water,
right.
which is basically the alternative. Don't use cubes. They have, they're invariably very salty and really not very nice.
Yeah.
But what's much the best is to get some canned stock and just simmer a chicken bone or two in it. And it's amazing how much more taste you'll have.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yes. I mean, if necessary, add a few chicken bones to the soup when you're making it. And then fish them out. Even 15 minutes will make a difference.
Hmm. One of the things I would like to talk with you now about is making stock.
Uh-huh.
Because this is such an important thing. I think if you can make stock, you know, you've really got the world by the tail,
mm-hmm.
I think. But sometimes stock, I'm not quite there yet with it, I guess, because my stock turns out like the picture where it says, this isn't it.
Oh, dear. You boiled it.
Oh, maybe that's it. It's,
probably.
Yeah, it's not that beautiful, clear product.
Boiled it.
Wow.
Stock. Oh, well, chicken stock you can make with raw bones or else the bones from cooked chicken. If you have roast chicken, never, ever, ever throw out the bones. But just put them in a pot, cover them with cold water. If you like, add a sliced onion, possibly a sliced carrot, but you certainly don't have to. A teaspoon of peppercorns, no salt, because when you use stock, very often you boil it down, whether you're making a sauce or whatever it is, and if you've added salt to the stock, you can't control the salt in the finished dish. And then you just bring the water to a boil, and a whole lot of froth will come to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Skim that off. And then simmer it very, very gently, and that's the key, not just to it looking clear, but to it not having that muddy taste that cloudy stock has, but basically as extracted too many, I guess, impurities from
mm.
the bones.
Mm.
And mind you, muddy stock is better than no stock at all.
Well, it's a little disappointing, though, or disheartening when you've worked, you know, in the kitchen and it's not quite...
Well, if you really want to get it right, you whisk up, depends how much stock you've got, but let's say you've got a couple of egg whites in a bowl, and stir them into the stock when it's cool, and bring it slowly to a boil, whisking hard. And what you're doing, of course, is you're doing a primitive kind of consommé, and you'll find that the egg white forms what they call a raft, which is a kind of filter, and it'll pick out all of the sludge and whatever it is that's clouding your stock, and you'll have lovely clear stock underneath.
Hmm. Now, how long should, once you bring it to a boil and then you calm down,
you put it on the side of the stove.
Right, and let it simmer. How long does that process take?
Well, if the bones are already cooked, it probably takes about an hour and a half. But if they're raw bones, I would say at least 2 hours. But what I do at home is I have a stock pot at the back of the stove all the time. And whenever we have, which is quite often, roast chicken or roast meat, we add the bones. And I just simmer it 20 minutes, half an hour. And every day I bring it just back to a boil. And even in a warm kitchen, that's enough to kill any bacteria that would turn it sour. And so one has a constantly revolving stock pot, and it changes its flavour all the time, depending on whether you've had chicken or whether you've had beef or whatever it's been. And I use the stock to make soup and the stock to make gravy. And whenever it gets a bit low, I just fill it up with water. And I keep that going probably 2 or 3 weeks without straining it. And you can tell when it needs straining. It gets to look very cloudy and the bones start falling apart. And then you strain it and you start again. And it's household stock, and chefs shudder, but it's just delicious and very useful.
Do you find yourself wearing two different kinds of cooking hats, one at home and one in a professional kitchen?
Oh, I think so, because students they come to learn the rules, they come to learn the music, they come to learn the scales. And at home, I cut all the corners that I know I can cut and a few more, because I've learnt the scales a long time ago. And I think that's one of the keys of enjoying being in the kitchen and hopefully being quite successful in the kitchen, is knowing the right way to do things and therefore knowing what's likely to go wrong, and if it does go wrong, what to do. But you can't know what's likely to go wrong and what to do until you've learnt the basics.
When you were learning, starting out, what kinds of mistakes were you most often capable of?
Oh, I'm a terrible, I'm always rushing into things and probably cooking things too fast. But I think much the most common, it's not really a fault, but carelessness in the kitchen, is not tasting things. And it's enormously important to season things right from the beginning of cooking. And that isn't, of course, just salt and pepper, but it's the pinch of sugar in the pea soup. It's the herbs. It's and ingredients vary all the time. So that the peas, for instance, may need more or less sugar or salt, depending how long you've had them, where they've come from. Has it been a lovely sunny year and with it just the right shower of rain that has made them all plump up and be delicious? Or do they need a bit of help and some more mint and so on? And it's very important to taste things right from the beginning. And of course, most importantly, before it goes to the table. But one of the most difficult things to instill into students is to taste things all the time.
Now, something I've learned on a cooking show on television is to taste every time you add another ingredient.
Which, I mean, it's very tiring to the palate. And chefs at the end of the day, of if they're on the line, in other words, that doing all of the practical cooking, will have tasted 200 or 300 different things. I mean, one goes, and that's why cooks never want to eat their own food at the end of the day. Because they've tasted it and smelt it.
What prompted you with this book, Cook It Right, to have photographs of things that are done perfectly and things that are done underdone or overdone? What gave you the idea for showing us, here's what it should look like and be like, smell like, feel like?
Yes, well, exactly. I mean, I really hadn't rationalized it, but we have a lot of young trainees who come to us, and one of the things, that the first things they learn, because we eat a lot of it, is roast chicken. And I went into the kitchen one evening and said, I don't think that's done yet. And the trainee had taken it out and was starting to make the gravy. And they said, but how do you know? And I said, well, it's obvious. It isn't brown and crispy, and it isn't pulling away from the bones. And then I thought, but it's maybe obvious to me, but why should it be obvious to someone that hasn't cooked roast chicken lots of times? And then as soon as you start thinking about all sorts of other things, how do you know when a cake is cooked? The test will say, press it with a fingertip and it should spring back. But it's much more than that. It looks really lovely and golden brown, and it's started to pull away from the sides of the pan, and it almost certainly smells wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I talk to people about when a thing's done, somebody told me just today, when one's making cream puffs, profiterole, she said, you know, if it isn't cooked, if you hold it to your ear, it'll be crackling to you. And sure, I'd never thought of it. But what it is that that choux pastry, when it's done, has dried. And so no more moisture is evaporating from it. But if you hold a hot choux puff to your ear and it's making a noise, it means that steam is still evaporating from it and it's not done. And there are all sorts of things like that, that when you actually think about it, that you realize that it's not just instinct, that there are reasons for all of these things. So it was a fascinating, fascinating book to do.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about chicken. Roast chicken is wonderful.
Yes.
And it's pretty easy to do it well, although it can go too long, and I suppose that's the biggest problem.
Oh, I think undercooked chicken is the big... Well,
you
cooked
just,
chicken,
yeah.
Of course, let's not get into salmonella. Undercooked chicken is actively dangerous, so, I mean, that's not a good idea. But undercooked chicken that is a bit rubbery, is a bit soggy, is just not wonderfully crispy but still moist, but tender enough to be just falling from the bone, there's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we can never get away, thank goodness, from butter. And good roast chicken, to me, is always cooked with butter. And I was taught that by a Norman cook. And the wonderful butter comes from Normandy. And that is that you must baste chicken and indeed all roasts all the time. And one of the big keys is the minute that it starts even making that little sizzling noise after about 10 minutes after it's been in the oven, keep brushing with butter. And it doesn't have to be quantities of butter. But butter browns things in a way that oil doesn't do. You don't get the lovely little sort of clumpy brown crispy bits with oil that you do with butter.
Now, if you happen to leave it in the oven too long, can you rescue it?
Yes, of course you can rescue it. You can, if it's really, really gone all to hell, you can make chicken salad. But if you, everybody's waiting for your nice roast chicken
right, sitting
out there at the table, one of the things that I do is brush it with a marinade of some kind. And in cook it right. I have an item for all of these different preparations. There are 150 different preparations ranging from poultry to meat to vegetables and bread to dessert. And in each of them, I give something called a quick fix, which is a way of finishing things off when they've gone a bit wrong. And the way I finish off a roast chicken is to brush it with an Asian marinade. And that, I do know where that one is. And that one, you just whisk together 2 tablespoons of soy sauce, 2 teaspoons of dark sesame oil, hopefully things that you have in the kitchen. And I'll give you some ideas. Finely chopped clove of garlic, 1 tablespoon of chopped fresh ginger, the juice of 1/2 lime, and of course you could use lemon instead, and 1 tablespoon of chopped fresh, here I have cilantro, but any chopped fresh herb, even parsley, would do. And just whisk them together and pour them over the chicken. And, of course, what that's going to do is, it's quite a dark sauce because of the soy, it's going to disguise any burnt bits. Because the bird is a bit dry and shriveled, it's going to absorb the marinade, and it's going to get a nice Asian kind of lift and bit of spice to it. And if you are missing the Asian ingredients, I would use plain vinaigrette dressing. Olive oil and wine vinegar, red wine vinegar if you have it, hopefully a bit of garlic, and it'll make quite a lot of difference to the chicken.
Would you also bring some of this to the table to put on?
Sure.
Okay.
Little bit of dipping sauce. Lovely.
What is it about these flavors that, these ingredients, soy sauce, sesame oil, garlic, ginger, that help make the best of a not-so-good situation?
Well, I think they're almost condiments, so that they have a vividness of taste that just, when things get overcooked, as you know, the flavor tends to get kind of flat. And all of those things, I mean, actually every single one of those ingredients, including the cilantro, have a kind of immediate vividness on the palate that are a distraction, which is half the point of saving things that have gone a bit wrong. I mean, it's all kind of sleight of hand and sleight of eye and palate. You want to distract from what's gone wrong.
Earlier we were talking about tasting for seasoning. Well, can you do anything if you've over-salted?
You picked one of the difficult things. And actually, over-salting is unfortunately very common, and it's very easy to do. I mean, you just sort of throw in the salt without thinking about it, and perhaps you've had a glass of wine while you're waiting for something to cook, and before you know where you are, it's too salty. Yes, there are two kind of main ways to go. One is to add a dairy product of some kind, because they need a lot of salt. And so that if you add them, they'll absorb, counterbalance too much salt. Milk is good, cream is good, butter's good, and surprisingly, yogurt is good. The other thing is to add an ingredient which that takes a lot of salt, so root vegetables, particularly potato, mushroom, and tomato. And you're going to change the dish a bit, but that doesn't matter. Pepper is an interesting one, too, which I hadn't really thought about until somebody asked me the question the other day. Chili pepper is one that hits, of course. And that's dairy food again. And it's no accident that a lot of the Asian, it's particularly Indian dishes, but Thai too, have bland and counterbalancing accompaniments. One of them, of course, are all of the pulse, the lentil purees and the bean purees. And the other is the dal. The raita yogurt mixtures that are usually yogurt and very often just yogurt and a herb. And both of those will soothe down the palate.
Starches and dairy.
Yep.
We're talking this afternoon with Anne Willen. She's an internationally recognized chef and cooking teacher. Her latest book is Anne Willen's Cook It Right. It's published by Reader's Digest. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, you're more than welcome in Champaign-Urbana. Our number, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free number, good, wherever you're listening. That number is 1-800-222-WILL or 222 9455. Our caller this afternoon is waiting for us on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Could you please repeat your scheme for clearing the stock?
It's a very simplified version of clarifying classic consommé or aspic. And if you've got cloudy stock, you simply whisk, I would say, one egg white per quart of stock. Just whisk until frothy in a bowl. And stir that into the cool stock. And then bring the stock slowly to a boil, taking at least 5 minutes and preferably about 10, and whisking with a nice big balloon whisk. And the egg white, of course, cooks very gradually, and it makes a filter. And the stock will get very cloudy, and as the egg white cooks, it'll go kind of white. And when it's almost to a boil, stop whisking, and all of the white will rise to the surface, and you'll be just appalled by what a nasty, laundry, dirty kind of raft you get floating on the top of the liquid. But underneath, the liquid will be lovely and clear. And you just strain it through clean dish towel, not washed with laundry detergent.
When comes the 3 minutes or 5 minutes of boiling?
Mm-hmm.
When is that done?
After you've added the egg white. So you want to add the lightly whisked egg white to the cool stock, and then over a low heat, whisk, 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 until the whole mixture is almost to a boil and is really quite kind of light-colored and cloudy.
And then quit whisking and let it boil for 3 minutes.
And then quit whisking and let it boil. And it'll froth up almost like milk coming to a boil. It'll have a head on it.
Now, is this a gentle boil or a big rolling boil?
You bring it until it will rise just like milk in the pan. And then you turn it out, and with a spoon you can just push aside the head on it, and you'll see clear liquid underneath. If it isn't quite clear, leave it to simmer very gently, and it'll kind of percolate itself through the raft on the top. Leave it to simmer 5 or 10 minutes, and then let it cool a bit before you strain it.
And with your habit of keeping your stock going perpetually, how often do you have to clear it?
I don't bother at all. I'm in my domestic kitchen, and nobody sees me using it. And I'm just adding it to make gravy, and hopefully nobody notices that my gravy is a bit cloudy.
No clear soups with your stock, then?
Certainly not consommé. But if one's getting into a really clear, sparkling soup, you're getting, as you know, into the higher realms. And you need to do more than just clearing a nice bit of chicken stock that has quite a lot of taste. You need to be adding ingredients to the clarification, such as possibly tomato, a little bit of chopped celery, a little bit of chopped carrot, even possibly a little bit of chopped beef, so that you get not just a lovely sparkling liquid, but something that has really intense flavor as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for
your
call this afternoon.
It's nice to have a technical question.
Yeah. You said when it comes to straining, don't use a towel that has been washed with laundry detergent.
Yeah.
So how do we come by a clean towel then?
Well, I mean, either rinse it really thoroughly so that you reckon you've got all of the soap out.
Mm-hmm.
A nice, quick way of doing it is using a coffee filter.
Oh.
But you've got to have a big coffee filter.
Right. Right. I suppose, too, if you could do out some of your dish towels, you know, in very, very hot water.
Yes.
You'd be in good shape there as well.
Yes. Or cheesecloth. But it's surprisingly difficult to find cheesecloth.
Hmm. Let's take another call on line three. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm very interested in cooking, and I've really enjoyed this show. The problem is a lot of the things that I'm guessing that you teach at a French style school with an emphasis on kind of like traditional cooking. My family just can't eat like that, and I'm interested in learning some real basic stuff at a school. But I don't think I can go to a school where I can pick up a lot of habits for like people who have got bad.
I'm delighted to talk to you, and I interrupt you at once. If that's all right.
Sure.
Because French cooking is just as universal and basic as anything that we have here. And steak and French fries, steak frites, is probably the most common dish in France.
Hmm.
Steak and French fries. I mean, the point about cooking in France is that the French like to think about things and do things in the best and the simplest way possible.
I really
enjoyed
like,
for instance, I mean, the vinaigrette dressing is French, and here we are all dressing salads wonderfully lightly with not very much of the very best olive oil and lots of nice different kinds of vinegars from all over the world. That's very, very French. They would never be dousing their salad with the traditional American dressing, Thousand Island, and all the rest of it. I think of France as not exactly the fount of all knowledge, but a wonderful place to learn cooking, because the French really do mind about the very best ingredients and the very freshest ingredients, and just cooking them very, very simply. So come to France.
I have heard that the French know food like Americans know advertising, which I guess says something about both. I'm interested in, like, Indian cooking,
mm-hmm.
Maybe South Asian and Southeast Asian cooking, and maybe a little bit of Middle Eastern cooking. Are there schools that cater to that sort of thing, or do you have to go to the country and learn?
There are schools where you will get very good teachers teaching in what I'd call lots of different, I don't want to say languages, idioms. So that it's particularly in the big cities, you will be offered a week of classes, of Thai classes, with one of the best Thai teachers in the world. Obviously, Italian cooking has really arrived here, and some of the very best Italian teachers in the world teach more in the States than they would back home in Italy. So I think, in fact, you probably will get better teaching in ethnic cooking in the States than in most of the home countries.
Is there a magazine that advertises these schools?
Yes. You'll find that all of the good nationwide food magazines have regular cooking school ads, and many of them run cooking school sections three or four times a year.
Hmm.
So that if you look at Bon Appetit, Cooking Light, Gourmet Magazine, Food and Wine, to mention just the bigger circulation ones, Eating Well, all of them will have a lot of cooking school, both professional and avocational school advertising.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for your call this afternoon. When it comes to, cooking is, it seems we're just in the throes of a big love affair with food in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And there are now places where you can go, resorts where you can go and have a vacation where you cook with famous chefs.
Yes.
How?
I run one myself.
I
probably not.
Yes. What kinds of things will one come away with after, vacationing in the kitchen with someone such as yourself?
Well, I teach, as you know, in France and also at the Greenbrier in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
In France, we have very small-scale classes. We take a maximum of 16 people, and so students are actually in the kitchen doing a lot of cooking, and they're learning with French chefs. So it's a very intensive hands-on experience. At the Greenbrier, which I think is probably more typical of most residential schools, I think I can say that, we take up to 60 students, and though we do some hands-on classes, most of the classes are demonstration, and we do a certain amount of wine tasting and cheese tasting. But what students learn is a lot of and hugely varied ideas and recipes to take home and try at home. And that's what our students come to us for, is new ideas. Mm-hmm. Most of them love to cook at home.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they don't even love to cook at home. They just love eating and they love exploring new ingredients and ways of looking at things, and perhaps it is Thai cooking or something that's just a little bit different. They love to meet other people who are also interested in food and that they can get to know as friends. They love meeting, of course, the experts in the field. And so we have very varied classes, and is indeed, I mean, when I say we, all of the schools like this offer very varied experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And we all find that the more teachers we have, the more varied the experience, the more the students have a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we looked up the Greenbrier on the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks like a wonderful time. There's golf and tennis and tea and concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And horseback riding and spa treatments and then, of course, working out in the kitchen.
That's right. We keep everybody very busy in the kitchen.
Yeah. We're coming to the last little bit of the time that we can spend together today here on the program. I wanted to ask you, though, before we go, about what's out there on the horizon in I don't know what angle you'd like to address, restaurants or different cuisines that will come to our attention, or new foods, new techniques. What do you see out there that excites you?
Well, I see all sorts of things, but what I very much hope,
mm-hmm,
is that I think we have two lost generations, and that is quite often people under 40, but certainly under 30, that haven't grown up, Americans I mean, that haven't grown up with somebody routinely cooking in the kitchen. And it's a bit like me, they are, all those two generations, or coming up three generations, are very literate on the computer and illiterate in the kitchen. And I'm illiterate on the computer, and though I can run one, I get quite nervous about what this wretched machine is going to do to me every time I sit down in front of it. And I think there's generations of people out there who get nervous going into the kitchen about what these ingredients and this stove are going to do to them when they try doing some cooking. And I think, I hope that there's much talk now of children's cooking classes. And, of course, children love to be in the kitchen because it smells good and it tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
And things are happening, and they enjoy it. And if we can just encourage more and more children to learn a little bit, enough to make cooking unterrifying and to make it familiar and welcoming, I think that would be a huge, huge move in the right direction and will transform the whole food scene in all sorts of directions that at the moment we may be unaware of.
Hmm. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
That's been a great pleasure, Celeste.
Take care.
Thank you for asking me.
Oh, I hope we can talk again someday in the future.
That would be great.
Take care.
You too.
Ann Willen has been our guest. Her latest cookbook is Ann Willen's Cook It Right. It's published by Reader's Digest.